Policy and Public Affairs to order. It is Wednesday, April 11th, 2007. Welcome, everybody. It should be a very, hopefully, good and productive day today for all of us. I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 519 and call, and Shannon, would you explain the bill?
Senate Bill 519 requires health insurers and the Department of Human Services through State Medical Assistance Program to cover specified to cover services performed using telemedicine, requires the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services and Director of Human Services to adopt rules.
Okay. I would like to ask Dr. Knight Richardson to please come forward.
Madam Chair, distinguished members of the committee, it is a privilege to be here this morning in support of this bill. I am, for the record, I am Norwood Knight Richardson, Vice Chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Oregon Health and Sciences University and the founder of the telemedicine program at that university, as well as Director of the Public Psychiatry Program at Oregon Health and Sciences University and Director of the Neuropsychiatric Institute. I'm here this morning being thankful of the privilege to very briefly and extemporaneously explain my support for this bill. Section 2, number 3, really is the heart of the bill. This bill was conceived to support and improve further access and health care to people in Oregon, we say rural Oregon, but the citizens of Oregon who do not have ready access to health care. I'm a psychiatrist, but this bill is intended to also cover other specialties. In fact, Friday I talked to a pediatric intensivist who is doing consultations in Eugene for children and who come to emergency rooms with problems where they don't have an intensivist in those hospitals. So it has applications across the board, including pathology. Our specialty particularly is suited for it because we don't have to do procedures on site, although I will tell you there are robotic procedures that are done now over distance. Since we started this approximately 2 years ago with a generous donation from one of Oregon's citizens, and I opened the first studio, the services that we provide have grown very greatly. We now provide services to the Department of Corrections and the prison system. The child side of the services has grown tremendously because there's a shortage of child psychiatrists, and we see children in Pendleton, we see children in Southern Oregon, and just the other day we signed a contract to see children on the Yellow Hawk Reservation, and we're working with Warm Springs Reservation as well. So the service, in terms of effectiveness, and that's what we have to consider here, is this a novelty that is a make-do, so to speak, and the outcomes are acceptable barely? And that's not true. We've actually been looking at surveys of efficacy since the 50s when the first crude methods of this were. And I'm happy to pause here and acknowledge the carrier of this bill, Senator Jason Atkinson, who I thank you endlessly for having the foresight to support this. But we found since the 50s that there's efficacy. The measures of efficacy have been somewhat crude, i.e. patient satisfaction and the physician satisfaction. And what both of those categories show is that it's somewhere in the 95 to 98% range. If you take do a study in which you compare the diagnostic accuracy of face-to-face versus telemedicine, you find that the accuracy approaches 100%. The same information given, et cetera. I see patients in the Katrina disaster area. I saw them yesterday. This university is the first to do this across-country telemedicine, and my patients have a variety of ailments, both medical and psychiatric, and most of them are suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, as you might imagine, from the disaster. But they spontaneously have told me, every one of them, that this has been a great service for them. It allows them with limited transportation to be gathered at one point, and it allows them to have frequent contact with a psychiatrist every 2 weeks or every week if necessary. I actually do limited neurological and physiological examinations through this medium by having the patient participate with me as well as the nurse. This bill has nothing to do with convenience for doctors. It has everything to do with access to health care for people who don't have it. And there may be occasions, although the bill talks about rural health care, where there are so few specialists, such as in pediatric neurosurgery, that even within the bounds of a densely populated area, this medium could be used for that kind of consultation. I'll keep my comments brief to that point, and if there are any questions, we'll be happy to ask them. But I once again urge you to pass this very needed bill before we had a joint resolution on telemedicine. I think it's time now to have an organized approach to it. One final point. This bill was designed to ensure quality. We're talking about the same quality of care as you would have in a face-to-face. The requirements of the practitioner are the same. In the way we've set it up, we also have safety measures. So yesterday I had a technical glitch, my first one, and the screen froze. In our contract, a technician is on site working it out within 10 minutes. Within 30 minutes, we will either have another camera up or we will reschedule, or if there's an emergency. We also have a dedicated phone line, and that dedicated phone line allows me to be right in contact with that patient. If, in fact, the video portion is down. So the bill also is hopefully speaking to the quality of care issue. Thank you very much. And if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Yes, I have questions, but would you want to say a few words, Senator Atkinson?
Thank you, Mrs. Chair, or Madam Chair. It's been a long morning already. For the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator, District 2. I want to thank the committee, and thank you, Madam Chair, for your deference of allowing us to get Dr. Knight Richardson here on Wednesday, and I think in even my tardiness, he covered all the salient points that this really is about access, and I'm sure you discussed how well the pilots are working in Astoria and Pendleton, and certainly the work in Katrina. So I am a supporting role for this bill only. Thank you.
Some questions came up last time, and that I'd like to have you respond to. And one is CMS has been guidelines for telemedicine should be the basis for telemedicine in Oregon. Can I get your response to that question? Because I'm not very familiar with the guidelines from CMS.
I will try to answer that, and I say try, Senator, because the CMS guidelines are fairly broad. This past summer, I actually went to Dennis Smith at Medicaid to get some idea of how much latitude we have. And what I was told by the director of Medicaid is basically theirs are guidelines. First of all, when you look at them in detail, they are broad enough to leave states a lot of latitude. And I asked him, I said, well, how much latitude do we have? And typical of CMS, they said, well, bring it to us and we'll tell you. He said, be creative. So I think there's enough. There's a lot of latitude, but we won't know until they essentially look at it and decide whether or not we've taken too much.
Another question that came up last time that helps me. I don't know if the committee has any. So when rules are being developed by DHS they would be using CMS probably as a guideline, but then.
To help you understand that, in fact, I have to reread it often to see exactly what they're saying. There's certain particular items, such as you are allowed to depreciate the cost of telemedicine against your Medicaid bill. You're allowed to account for the savings in transportation that you accrue secondary to using telemedicine, and so you have to make an estimate of how much whether you are spending to go to the patient or the patient is spending to come to you if telemedicine is being used, and those savings you get to keep, and it's a way that Medicaid supports financing the spread of telehealth. Indeed, the cost of the T1 line, which is a type of line that you can use in telemedicine, or optic fiber, can also be passed on, and those costs, of course, concern the community mental health centers, who are more strapped for financing than, say, a general hospital that might be using it in its pediatric ICU.
Have you done any estimates on how much this would cost our Medicaid program?
No, I have not, Senator.
Okay. All right. Another question that came up. Are any other further questions on that?
Yes. Not on that. But
okay. Go ahead, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, and good morning,
Doctor. Good morning, Senator.
And Senator. We had testimony the other day from Peace Health raising several concerns, and one was, and this is using their language, they're asking that we reconsider the preference of video conference over telephone or fax. And then they go on to say, we've all had someone insist on setting up a PowerPoint presentation when a few sentences would work. The bill would require the proposed rules to prohibit the use of telephone or fax when video conferencing is available. While this may be an appropriate discussion for the rulemaking process, we recommend this provision be deleted from the bill. There's one other concern, but if you'd like to address.
Certainly. And, Senator, I did talk to them about that provision. That provision actually does come directly from Medicare and Medicaid, neither of which will pay for a telephone conversation with a patient unless that is attached to a video conference. In the case that I had yesterday where the line on the other end in Louisiana actually failed, mm-hmm. and I had to continue my conversation with the patient by phone, mm-hmm. but it began by video. Basically, what Dennis Smith at Medicaid told me is that they were afraid of the inability to control quality with just phone alone. And one might argue that, but that definitely both Medicaid and Medicare do not allow that.
That's important to know.
And then continuing, Madam Chair, an additional concern from Peace Health was requesting that, and again in their language, delete requirement for rule requiring face-to-face visits within a reasonable distance. The bill requires the rules to prohibit the use of telemedicine when a face-to-face consultation is available within a reasonable distance. And their question was, what is a reasonable distance from the patient's home or work? And for the reasons outlined above, specifically scheduling, reducing vehicle trips, they are recommending that the provision be deleted.
And thank you, Senator Gordley. I also talked to Peace Health about that provision as well. What in crafting this bill, what we were concerned with was that it would become a vehicle of convenience, and that wanted to emphasize was using this for people who had poor access. I, in my mind, at least conceived that a reasonable distance could be defined by the rules. We often use the term a reasonable person without limits on what reasonable is. And so perhaps that's too vague, but probably a consensus could be reached on that. It was not meant for someone in North Salem to treat someone in South Salem, or North Portland to treat someone in South Portland, because I would think that that's a reasonable distance to travel. And if your resources are then completely overwhelmed by for convenience visits as opposed to serving those populations that have no further access, then I think the system once again becomes a model for urban care and does not provide that availability for the population that we're identifying here. And that's why it's stated like that.
And then their final concern is that the goal should be expanded beyond underserved communities. They say the bill directs state departments to adopt rules to promote the goal of improving access to health services in medically underserved areas and improving patient access to health care specialists in geographic areas where there's a shortage of such specialists, as you've already pointed out in your testimony. But they say the relevant state departments could interpret this language to mean federally designated health professional shortage areas, which are specific zip codes. And Peace Health is suggesting that the goal should be, quote, improving timely access to specialty medical services or in lieu of transferring the patient to another medical facility.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. We also discussed that, and I can say I really don't have any opposition to that, and also say that in constructing the bill, we never had in mind that these were just federally designated areas. Again, the rules can probably address that, but that was never the intention of the legislation.
Thank you for making the record on that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I speak quickly to her first question?
Mm-hmm.
And that has to do with T1 lines and the federal requirements that will come down largely for confidentiality and quality of care. I think the thing that's most important on this bill is to realize the focus on access and the focus on professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that when we review this bill and we review its effectiveness in Oregon 2 years from now, the technology will be entirely different. The reason we used to talk 4 years ago about T1 lines and the access of connecting rural communities to the Internet, four months ago now, I was in a war zone in Iraq talking to my son in Oregon, who was sitting, he's four, he was sitting in the bathtub, and we were video chatting on wireless connections. So the in Asia right now, video chatting cell phone to cell phone, where they have, actually in China, they've actually invested more in wireless technology than in traditional telephone lines, and which would be part of the same infrastructure on T1. The technology is growing much faster. And so before we get to that point where technology in America is handheld video or Jason in Iraq talking to a four-year-old in the bathtub, I think the important thing of this bill is setting up those professional protocols and making sure that the bill emphasizes access to care at the highest professional level for the practitioner. I think once you get to that point, that's actually the fundamental thing that the bill's trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Another concern that came forward was they felt that the health professional definition was broad. Was that the intent? I know insurers will be concerned about that. And is there leeway to tighten that up?
That was the intent, Senator. Thank you for the question. And I think the rules can tighten that up. We did not want to proscribe any particular clinical specialty in the use of telemedicine. We have. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, and then finally, it would be nice if in the bill. Something could be said to make sure the services are covered under a health plan. And can you respond to that? Because we have contracts with various groups, and some contracts have the services covered, telemedicine covered, others do not, and it would be nice to have that as an option, but I need to get your input on that.
The intent of the bill as crafted was to cause anyone who paid for face-to-face to pay for telehealth. Any insurer, any group plan who paid for face-to-face would pay for similar services over telemedicine. So that was the intent. So if that's not clear,
we need to
recraft that.
So that's great. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Courtney.
This is beyond me, but I noticed this. It says telemedicine means the provision of any health care service, including but not limited to the practice of medicine across state lines. It goes on from there. So it's not limited to the practice of medicine. So help me, doctor. That means what else am I doing?
Well, in the case of psychotherapy, for instance, that might be paid for, or substance abuse counseling, is not traditionally necessarily thought of as the practice of allopathic medicine, and that's probably an adjective that might have been used, which or somatic medicine, as opposed to using therapies.
Okay, just one more question, so I could, since I know this, the bill's trying to do something else. Where does the physician's judgment come in here? I'm not a physician. Where does the physician say, I'm getting nervous, I'm going to stop this way of dealing with it, I'm getting nervous? Are they protected, or is the OMA or the world in they live, they have to, once they start, go all the way through? Or can they stop at any time saying, I know what I see, and I know what I hear, and I know what my experience are, and I know what my training is, but somehow or other, without you really in front of me, I got to stop. I know that's not really what you want to do here, but I just, for some reason, I just like to ask that question since he's here. If you would, I hope you're not offended if you don't think it's an appropriate question in terms of this is more going in another direction. But I'm just curious about that man or woman who has a patient far away, good idea, but they've got to stop.
Actually, Senator, that's an excellent question.
Excellent question.
It really is. And it is a question that goes to the judgment that any physician uses, even in face-to-face, when am I beyond my own capabilities and I need to call in a consultation. In my case, where I see people almost 2,500 miles away, there are other physicians, proximate physicians, not necessarily psychiatrists, that I can call upon if the patient has an emergency. So it really is up to the physician or the clinician's judgment as to whether or not this patient is too fragile for this modality. We also have a complex patient agreement for care in which the patient has the right to request face-to-face at any time if this is not satisfactory to them. It explains to them the limitations of the telehealth method. And once again, you were not here, but I was rating, recalling the rate of satisfaction, which is between 95% and 98%. But when there is a difficulty, what we do is we do try to find someone who is available. But if you are, say, in Malheur County and you're having a difficulty, that's maybe the time that transportation has to be arranged for you to be brought to the nearest face-to-face psychiatrist.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Doug.
I just got a letter that's from Providence Health Plan, and it was addressing the issue that I was concerned addressing regarding refining the bill. And I'll just state, Providence and other Oregon health insurers have already begun to implement telemedicine and e-visit services. They feel if legislation is needed to foster telemedicine within the Oregon Medical Assistance Program, as proposed in Section 3 of the bill, they would not oppose the efforts, but they are concerned, however, about extending provisions that are specific to the medical assistance program into the commercial health insurance market. Therefore, in Section 2 of the bill, they recommended the addition of a new subsection 3 as follows: insurers that operate managed health insurance plans, as defined in ORS 743.801, may negotiate the payment rates that apply to contracted providers for covered services that are performed using telemedicine. Payment rates for non-contracted providers for covered services that are performed using telemedicine shall be subject to the rules adopted under subsection 4 of this section. Does that make...
I think I understand what they're saying, although the last sentence I would have to look at to craft my answer specifically and accurately. Number one, I'll go back to this. I'll go back to the statement that the intent of the bill was to cover any payment system that paid for face-to-face as being required to pay for telemedicine. And that's a general. I don't understand the sentence about a member of the panel, the preferred panel versus. Thank you.
Well, what I would like to do, since I don't want to really wordsmith this bill right now, we have a number of bills that we need to address. I would like you to take a look at the proposed amendments. See if there's any changes that you and the others who have concerns about this bill, if you could meet with them. And I think that would be John Powell from Blue Cross Blue Shield. And who was the author of that bill?
The one that was
from Providence.
Was Nyberg.
Mm-hmm.
Edward.
Yes. Nyberg. And then with Peace Health regarding that, and if there are any amendments that could come forward to that, I would like those to be submitted. If not, I want to go ahead and request a fiscal for this bill as it stands, and then see refining the bill if we can get a compromise with those who have concerns.
Thank you, Senator. And is there a process to get me the contact numbers?
Yes, I will have my staff work with Shannon, the administrator, in developing the contacts and think. Yes, and yes, Senator Adams.
Madam Chair, if the people in the room who have those amendments would like to talk, I'm sure we can find a room somewhere in this building since we're all probably here for a few minutes and discuss that.
Unfortunately, Senator Atkinson, I have psychiatric security review board starting at 8:30.
Don't I have any pull in this building? Madam Chair, if I could make one other quick point.
Yes.
That I don't think was brought up, but is very, very much a big motivator for us to pass this bill. Senator Cruz and I represent areas and counties that are strongly hit by the proposed elimination of the ONC funds at the federal level. And one of the biggest things that we have heard, which is broader and much bigger than this bill, but is the county's work for Oregonians who need mental health services at the county level. And the counties have been threatening with absolute sincerity that if the ONC funding isn't there, they're going to take the mental health system that they have been running and kick it back to the state. So you deal with it. Well, as we all know, the state's not ready to, number one, doesn't have the capacity to handle that, and number two, certainly is not prepared to handle that in a comprehensive way that would not allow these people to fall through the cracks. So as we think about this from a policy perspective, one of the motivators, I think, for those of us in ONC counties as well as those of us that represent largely rural counties is to see if this cannot be not an answer for the decrease in ONC funding and certainly not a bailout for county mental health services, but perhaps another avenue of access to care that could be tremendously beneficial. So that needs to be on the record also and is also a big motivator.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess I'd just suggest that, seeing how this is Senator Atkinson's bill, and I'm fully supportive of it, that maybe he would be the appropriate nexus between those with concerns and Dr. Knight Richardson.
And that's fine. Will you be able to work with Shannon then in getting those amendments?
Madam Chair,
And I'll let my staff off the hook.
Sure. Like to
wonderful. Okay. Thank you.
Thank
all right.
You.
Thank you very much. I do not have time. I know that Tim Malone has come, but we do not have time to hear any more on this bill, and I apologize for that because I know he had come a long way, but we need to be moving on. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 519. And I will open just a brief public hearing on Senate Bill 791. The amendments are not ready, but I would like to have, so I do not want to cover any of that right now. We will wait for the amendments, and but I would like administrative staff to ask for a fiscal on it. with the amendment, they will definitely need to have the amendment before a fiscal is done. We only have five more sessions after this before this committee will close all Senate bills, hearing all Senate bills. So that's why we're trying to move quickly. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 791, and I'll open a public hearing on SJR 26. Is Angela Biltz, and this will only take very short amount of time. It's not quite as weighty as, but it is a fun bill, I should say. And I won't
put
even
the words right out of my mouth. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angie Biltz, and thank you for taking a brief moment, as you said, out of your consideration of important policy matters this morning to talk about a fun bill, which is the celebration of the Portland Rose Festival's 100th anniversary that is happening beginning next month. With me today is Jeff Curtis, Executive Director of the Portland Rose Festival Association. I told him I'd have to get a cane and get him out if we aren't in and out very quickly, so with that, I will turn it over to him.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity this morning. We're on the verge of a very historic...
And introduce yourself.
Excuse me, Jeff Curtis. I'm the Executive Director of the Portland Rose Festival Association, a nonprofit Oregon corporation that produces Oregon's signature celebration, the Rose Festival. We are on the verge of a monumental occasion, the 100th anniversary of the Rose Festival. In 1907, we were created with a mission to put this region on the map through a special event that's inclusive of all, both children and our community. And today we do that in a very big way. We're one of the largest civic celebrations in the United States. And this year is our 100th anniversary. We've survived a couple of world wars, a depression, and many things, and our festival continues. It draws about 2 million people annually and produces an economic impact of about $80 million. This year, our centennial is something that will springboard us into our future. And we're calling on the state of Oregon to support the festival and invite all Oregonians to come to Portland and participate. This is truly a festival for all. It's inclusive for all, and that's our mission, and it's for all citizens of the state, including, and I will add that a new initiative this year under Mayor Potter's vision is to actually invite all Oregon mayors to march with him in the Grand Floral Parade, which will take place this year. This is an Oregon festival, not just a Portland festival, and even Mayor Potter sees that vision. So I call on your support of this bill to bring all Oregonians to Portland and celebrate the Portland Rose Festival.
Thank you. Senator Courtney.
Thank you. Angie, were you a former Rose Festival princess?
Why, yes, Senator. Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, I am proud to say I was Roosevelt High School's Rose Festival princess in 1995.
Were you queen of all rosary as well?
A very nice young woman by the name of Larissa Pennington from Lincoln High School was the queen of my year.
Well, then I'm not supporting that.
I'm still licking my wounds from not winning. It's nice of you to rub salt.
Oh, my.
Okay. Is there any other discussion on this bill?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say, as the sponsor of this bill, that I'm really excited about it, and I invite members of the legislature to come join me, and that what we want to do is do something very special to invite legislators across the state to come, so I'll work with you on that piece.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I agree. Rose Festival is always a fun time in the metro area. We certainly want to share that with the rest of the Oregonians. If there's no further discussion, I will close the public hearing on SJR 26, and I'd like to open a work session on SJR 26.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move SJR 26 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Carter moves SJR 26 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Resolution adopted. And Senator Carter, would you please carry this bill?
I will. Thank you.
With that, I'll close the work session on SJR 26, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 656. Shannon.
Senate Bill 656 modifies the circumstances under which optometrists must refer patients being treated for glaucoma to an ophthalmologist. It recognizes certain existing statutory provisions.
Okay, with that, I would like to invite Nan Heim, Bob Tilbolt, and Kevin McKinney to come. Oh, but Senator Carter is going to talk first. Go for it.
Madam Chair, Margaret Carter, Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland, and since this is my bill, I appreciate having the introductory remarks on this bill, because I think that it is very important at the most imperative that we have a teachable moment here in terms of why I felt this bill necessary. I worked with the glaucoma medical community some 2 years ago in a community forum where we had people to come in, and the condition of many Americans that came, Oregonians who came in that day, was absolutely appalling to me in terms of their level. glaucoma was one of the overarching issues that most of them faced with, and then at a very high point, not too far away from blindness. And it is estimated that over 3 million Americans have glaucoma, but only half of those know that they have it. In the African American community, glaucoma is the leading cause of blindness in our community. And glaucoma is 6 to 8 times more common in African Americans than Caucasians. African Americans aged 45 to 65 are 14 to 17 more times likely to go blind from glaucoma than Caucasian with glaucoma in the same age group. In my family alone, in two generations before me and a generation under me, we're dealing with the issue of glaucoma. And I'm one of those people who stay very much on top of this issue because I know its danger. The most common form that most African Americans have suffered with is called the angle glaucoma. And it accounts for about 19% of all blindness among African Americans compared to 6% in Caucasians. And 16.1% of African Americans were even unfamiliar with glaucoma. So an education program is imperative. Access to health care is a moral imperative. And being able to be directed at the right time to the right person to be able to deal with this devastating disease in our community is very, very important. So, Madam Chair, I want to give thanks to you and this committee for being able to hear this bill today, because it is a moral compass for me in being able to save the eyesight and consequently the death of many people that I come in contact with in my district and my community as an African American. So thank you very much for hearing this bill, and I look forward to those with technical expertise to come behind me.
Thank you, Senator Carter.
And Madam Chair, I just want to say also that we do support the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, with that, Nan Heim, Bob Tilbolt, and Kevin McKinney.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology, and thank you for hearing this bill this morning. With me are two of our members, Bob Tybalt and Kevin McKinney. Bob, I'm just going to briefly give their backgrounds. Bob, after graduating from college, went to University of Texas Medical School, did his internship at Good Samaritan, and then a three-year residency at OHSU. Kevin is a graduate of Baylor Medical College. He did did an internship in Texas and did a five-year residency and fellowship in glaucoma at the University of Iowa. He practiced in Saudi Arabia for several years, and for the last 9 years he has practiced as a glaucoma specialist in Milwaukee and Oregon City. Bob has practiced as a general ophthalmologist in Salem for the last 15 years. Both of them work closely with optometrists, and both of them speak with great respect of their optometric colleagues. I want to speak just briefly about the development of this bill. It started after the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association invited us to meet with them and explain to us that they would like to delete from statute the current requirement that glaucoma patients, before an optometrist treats a patient for glaucoma, they must consult with an ophthalmologist or other physician. After that meeting, we had a series of meetings to discuss their recommendation and its implications for glaucoma care. And what came out of that meeting, and I want to emphasize that the discussions at those meetings always, always centered on what is best for glaucoma care, for patients with glaucoma. What could we propose that might enhance patient care, that might improve the chances for some patients of saving their visions? And Senate Bill 656 is the result of those meetings. I want to say just one thing before I turn it over to Dr. Tybalt about the bill. Legislative Council decided in their wisdom to use this bill to reorganize some of the existing statute, and that has led to some confusion. Lines 6 through 10 on page 1 are actually existing statute. As you can see on page 2, they've deleted it from some other place in the law and they've moved it here. And that was a Legislative Council move. Our new language is lines 11 through 20. And our bill also deletes the current provision of consulting with an ophthalmologist before initiating glaucoma treatment. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Tybalt to have him tell you something about glaucoma and why we believe this bill is so important. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we thank you for this opportunity to speak on Senate Bill 656. I'd like to just review some of the basic elements of... My name is Bob Tybalt. I'm an ophthalmologist in Salem. Thank you. If I may, I'd just like to review some of the basic elements of glaucoma and then how those relate to this bill. Glaucoma is an eye disease in which the optic nerve, the main cable between the eye and the brain, is damaged. The most common variety of glaucoma is open-angle glaucoma, in which eye pressure is elevated, and with that elevated pressure, there comes damage to the optic nerve. We all start off with about 1.5 million nerve fibers in each optic nerve, and those are designed to last us for our entire lives. With glaucoma, with increased pressure, some of those nerve fibers atrophy and die, and if enough of those are lost, then we lose vision. The essential feature of glaucoma is that if vision is lost, it is not recoverable. The goal in treating glaucoma is to prevent loss of vision. So this is the most important thing, and it's unique about glaucoma because if you lose time, you lose vision. The goal of this bill is to facilitate timely referral and consultation of patients who, based on the criteria outlined in the bill, are at risk, imminent risk for losing vision. So that if a person's eye pressure is not controlled, if there is evidence of progression of visual field loss or a change in the appearance of the optic nerve, then those are markers of instability, progression of disease, and these are the individuals who are at imminent risk for losing vision. And this is why we, in this bill, would mandate that optometrists consult or refer their patients with an ophthalmologist at this critical time when the likelihood of vision loss is increased. The logic behind the referral process is that while optometrists are have the privilege of prescribing medicines to lower eye pressure, there are other ways to lower eye pressure. In America, the standard of care usually begins with the administration of eye drops to lower eye pressure. If that doesn't work, then one proceeds to laser. And if that doesn't work, then one proceeds to an operation on the eye itself to create a passageway for the fluid inside the eye to leave at lower resistance and thereby lower the pressure. Only those latter two surgical techniques are performed only by ophthalmologists. So if you have a patient who has reached a point where they are at risk for losing vision, the next steps are surgical, and only an ophthalmologist can provide those services. So that's the core of the rationale behind this bill. And I know you have a very busy docket, and so I will end it there. Certainly we'll be happy to entertain any questions. We thank you for your consideration and ask for your support for this bill. Thank you.
Just one question about how many consults do you get from optometrists? Is it frequent? Is it infrequent?
I have an optometrist in my office. I work closely with several community optometrists, and so I receive a fair number of referrals as far as the number goes per week.
No, I just want to know that it happens.
It happens.
And it's okay. Thank you. All right. Any other questions? All right. Now there. Thank you very much, panel, for coming. And pardon?
Yeah, the doctor hasn't spoken.
Oh, you were going to speak too. I thought you were just decoration.
And members of the committee, thank you. Hopefully, pleasant to look at. My name is Kevin McKinney. I'm an ophthalmologist, also and a glaucoma specialist, working out of Oregon City, Milwaukee. And actually, I am here primarily to answer questions, but just to further some comments that Dr. Tybalt made regarding glaucoma and its therapy. He mentioned that medication is the first line of therapy in America, but that is actually in contrast to England, where the first line of therapy is surgery, either laser therapy or trabeculectomy. And the research has been done and has clearly shown that these are equally effective therapies. There are social reasons and political reasons why those happen differently in the two countries, but it goes to show that the selection of initial therapy is actually something that you make based on the patient's status. And so to offer the full spectrum of treatment to a patient here in the U.S., you need to be able to offer laser treatment and surgical treatment from the start, if that's what the patient chooses or if that's what's appropriate in their situation. This is one reason why we feel early in the process an ophthalmologist should be evaluating the patient so that they can provide the full spectrum of treatment. There is a temptation to, if you only have a certain number of tools in your toolbox, to use those and to go through those tools and exhaust them before you try to move on to what might actually be more effective therapy. So you might delay, again, this issue of timeliness, you might delay appropriate therapy working through different medications when really the patient at that point should be evaluated by someone who can offer the full spectrum of therapy. In answer to your question as well to Dr. Tybalt about number of consultations, I see patients from optometrists in our community, but also up the Columbia River Gorge, down the Willamette Valley, who are referred to Oregon City. And so there is the mechanism for that type of interaction to occur already. And I think that that is in the best interest of those patients. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question? Yes,
Dr. McKinney.
Yes.
I hope you're all right in terms of what was said, because I will tell you something. In my long life, I'd have given anything if someone just once in my life had referred to me as a decoration. Please, I'll tell you, buddy, let me be a decoration once in my life. So I hope you undertook it in that vein.
Gratitude is on record.
All right. Thank you very much, panel. I appreciate it. With no questions. Now, I have six in opposition, and I truly only have time for three. So amongst the three of six of you, can you determine which of you are going to come forward? The first three were Wesley Vorpahl, David Plunkett, and Carol Timpor. But if Wayne Schumacher, Dr. Robert Ford, or Dr. Frank Story want to take...
Can we have one more besides me? All
right, well, we have about 10 minutes, so if...
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Dr. Robert Ford. I practice primarily in Chehalis, Washington, but I own a facility in Portland, and I want to thank you, Senator Carter, for so effectively presenting this problem. Glaucoma is a serious and dangerous disease. It's danger because it sneaks up, and it can do irreversible harm before there's a chance, and then there's no chance to fix it and turn it around. And I've been working closely with optometry for 20 years now, and it's my mission to improve the quality of eye care in the Northwest. And I own facilities in five states, including Alaska and Oregon and Idaho, Montana, and Washington. I've supervised the company. Because I own it, I'm responsible for over 100,000 surgeries in the last 20 years. And my goal is to help you make the right decision as to how best to improve the quality of glaucoma care in the state of Oregon. And I feel passionately that the secret is trust. There's got to be trust between everybody who is responsible for this. And like it or not, there's division in the care of eyes. Optometrists care for eyes and ophthalmologists care for eyes. And we've got to work together. When I was trained 20-plus years ago, I developed what a lot of ophthalmologists have, distrust for optometry. Fortunately, it's not as bad now. More ophthalmologists trust optometry, but we've got to encourage trust for optometry. My dad was a family practitioner, and so as I watched my dad practice, they didn't call them family practitioners back then. They called them GPs. And I could see that sometimes people didn't trust GPs. And since then, I've watched GPs occasionally make mistakes. And one of the mistakes a GP can make is fail to refer a patient on a timely basis. My dad didn't do that because my dad was good. But some GPs are not as good as others. But when they fail to refer, the reason they do is because they don't believe the person they refer is going to treat them with respect.
At least that's
one of the reasons. So, but if they have a close relationship, they'll refer promptly. So my company works with more than 10,000 optometrists in the five states, and we try to honor those guys and ladies. We try to make them feel like when they refer a patient to us, they're going to be treated with the utmost respect. And believe me, they refer promptly. And there are a lot of other diseases besides glaucoma where referral is essential. And my dad, as a GP, he wasn't able to do surgery. There are a lot of things he cared for that he didn't have the tool in his toolbox to fix. But because he knew the other docs that he worked with trusted him, he referred promptly. Trust is the key. And so what we want to do, and we're willing to cooperate, and if you want to start a mission in Oregon that focuses on minorities or what have you, we'd be happy to get in there and help train optometrists, help encourage them to refer more promptly. But the legislature stepping in and saying, here's the law, buddies, you've got to refer this patient under these circumstances, that isn't the answer. It's the opposite of the answer. It will reduce trust rather than increase trust. Education is the answer to all problems in society, including the care of glaucoma. Thank you so much for listening to me.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Wesley Vorpahl. I'm an optometric physician who has been in practice in Salem for 23 years. I currently serve on the Board of Optometry, the State Board of Optometry, and I'm here today to represent them in opposition to this bill. Senate Bill 656 proposes to fix a problem that does not exist. In 14-plus years that optometrists have been treating glaucoma, the Oregon Board of Optometry has yet to see a single complaint brought against an optometrist or see a single malpractice case regarding optometric care of patients with glaucoma. We have yet to see any evidence of a problem. This bill takes the unprecedented step of putting practice protocols for treating glaucoma in statute. Treatments of glaucoma will continue to evolve, and it is likely that we will need to return to the legislative body on numerous occasions in order to update our law. Another problem. This bill would create an unnecessary burden on many patients living in rural areas of the state. These patients would be forced to drive long distances in order to see an ophthalmologist when appropriate care is available in their nearby town. Finally, the Oregon Board of Optometry exists to regulate and monitor the practice of optometry to assure the citizens of Oregon are receiving safe and appropriate care. The Oregon Board of Optometry has the expertise to regulate the profession within current statutes. Senate Bill 656 will dilute this authority. I urge the members of the committee to carefully consider this bill and vote no. And I would be happy to answer questions.
Question?
Senator Card.
Doctor, I was trying to look in the bill to see where the bill requires people to see an ophthalmologist, and I don't see that. Can you show me that area? Maybe I'm overlooking.
The bill requires a consult when a patient needs, or as written now, it requires a referral, but that's been changed by the -2 amendments, and requires a consult with an ophthalmologist. Whether the form of that consult is going to depend on the ophthalmologist that you're dealing with. Some may indeed require a visit, and that I wouldn't think that uncommon.
Madam Chair, just to follow up. Doctor, as I'm looking at subsection 3 of section 2, and the new language will take care of this in terms of consultation, but it says if the glaucoma progresses despite the use of single glaucoma medication, more than one medication is required to control the glaucoma, or a secondary glaucoma develops. So it says that there's a process by which you would only have, you would need to consult with an ophthalmologist after these steps have gone through. I'm trying to see where it would shorten or keep patients in rural Oregon or make it hard for them to see a doctor or to see you without going to see an ophthalmologist. I don't see that where that is the case.
Chairman Lewis Anderson, Senator Carter, thank you for that question. My practice is not unusual in that I treat several hundred patients with glaucoma. Many of those patients have secondary glaucomas mm-hmm. or require the use of multiple medications. When I have a patient with glaucoma whom I am not able to control with appropriate therapy, then I most certainly make the consult or ask for a consult from the appropriate ophthalmologist. I, like most optometric physicians, want the best for my patients.
Could I comment on it, Madam Chair, on that question?
We need to wind up, so you can comment. Yes,
briefly. Okay. The way the bill prescribes care is very reasonable. The question is whether those kinds of medical details, how many medications and what to do next, whether that kind of stuff belongs in legislation. I feel those are professional decisions based on professional judgment and professional education, and you can't be making laws that tell doctors, either my dad as a family doctor or primary care eye doctors, you can't be micromanaging how many medications and when they do what. That's professional stuff. And education, not legislation, is the answer to that, in my opinion.
I understand that. Just one follow-up, Madam Chair. Doctor, you know, I've been on Human Services Committee for 22 years, and most of my work has been around scope of practice. And you guys have had legislation in the law on five different occasions, and so now we find this group that is saying all we want optometrists to do is give a phone call, and if there's a problem, and I don't think that they're limited to one area, because like you have five different states and you travel to those different states. I understand that ophthalmologists can move across the state as well when they need to be called upon. So my concern is that I agree with you. It would be really the ideal state if people could develop relationships of trust and get along with each other and make things all right. But obviously there's something wrong here, that you have come four or five times, not you the person, but your association, on five different times with legislation. This is their first time coming since I've been here in the 22 years. And so my concern is that it is inconsistent to say that it should not be in statute, because everything is just about in statute. But I just want to say that I don't think that this is going to cause any problems in rural Oregon in terms of a patient having to travel outside of their particular areas to see an ophthalmologist. And I just wanted the record to be straight on that piece. And I want things to work well in this state, quite frankly, because I think that there is no room for enemies, because all of us are in this together.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Schumacher. I'm the Executive Director of the Optometric Physicians Association of Oregon. And I want to clarify, Dr. Bob Ford is a fairly well-known ophthalmologist and is testifying essentially as an ophthalmologist, not as an optometric physician. He's not a member of our association either, so I just want to correct Senator Carter on that. I just want to wrap up this with some fairly succinct testimony. This is very troubling, incredibly troubling legislation. It does set a precedence to put specific protocols, medical protocols, in statute, protocols that are consistently evolving, which means we will be back to change them. Members of this committee have signed on to a bill, Senate Bill 717, that basically states we don't really want to hear these things in the Senate or in the legislature. We'd rather have a review panel, and we'd like to have a report from them. This is doing exactly the opposite of the intent of that bill. I think this is very dangerous ground, and I also want to emphasize Dr. Ford's point. This questions the professional judgment of optometric physicians. It's saying that they do not have the education, the skills, and the training to make the determination to refer or to get a proper consult. This is already happening. For 14 plus years, optometry has been successfully treating and properly referring. The question would come, to quote a rather well-known lady, where's the beef? This is troubling. I'd love to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. And having worked with Scope of Practice, we do put protocols in. I'm trying to remember, I think we authorized optometrists to prescribe drugs, including some injections, and then we allowed a broader formulary than most states. So to me, isn't that protocol?
Madam Chair, in my mind, and I think in our mind, that isn't actually a protocol. That's actually a scope issue. In other words, what drugs or what scope of practice do you have? This is specific protocol that says when this happens, this happens. That's very troubling ground. There are a few protocols, but usually they're time issues. For an example, with workers' comp issues, those are more of a management monetary kind of issue. This goes way, way, way beyond that. So.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Courtney.
Well, I think we're splitting hairs, Doctor. If the legislature makes scope of practice decisions, and we do it all the time, and that's why we're struggling with another bill to try to deal with it. We don't have the medical background. We're being asked all the time to make decisions. You call it protocol, call it scope of practice, because the public relies on us. When they go see that man or woman and they're looking into their eye, they know what they're doing. And we don't have that kind of training, so there's that issue. I just want to ask, the preceding panel said that the eye drop is first, followed by laser, followed by surgery. Do you agree with that analysis in terms of controlling glaucoma?
Yes.
So let me ask a question then. If the person is taking an eye drop, that's allowed here, you've prescribed it, and the pressure doesn't stabilize, do you then refer them to an ophthalmologist?
Senator Anderson, or Chair Anderson, Senator Courtney, yes, if I'm not able to control a patient's glaucoma, I would absolutely send them to an ophthalmologist who is appropriate to treat that disease. And that I do that based on my clinical judgment, my 23 years of experience, as a practicing optometric physician, my education.
Right. And I don't see how this bill contradicts that. I'm just reading not even the amendments. I'm just reading the language in the bill. I don't know. I don't see how that contradicts that.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Courtney, this bill is telling me as an optometric physician that when I have patients on one medication and I'm not able to control their pressure, that I need to get a consult from an ophthalmologist rather than use my own clinical judgment in prescribing perhaps an additional medication, or if it's appropriate to go ahead and send that patient to an ophthalmologist for perhaps a laser treatment. It's taking my clinical judgment out of the picture and putting it into statute.
You don't do, just one more, you don't do lasers or surgery, is that right or wrong?
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Courtney, no, I do not.
That decision would be made by an ophthalmologist.
That's correct. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. I would like to read into the record the testimony in opposition to this bill from Dr. Frank Story. He's an optometric physician and practices in Staten, and he goes to Mill City, which is about just east of Salem here, and provides medical care for that community. And I also want to read into the record the testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 656 from Dr. Carol Timpone, who is a optometric physician professor professor of optometry at Pacific University College of Optometry and attending doctor in the ocular disease and special testing clinic. Thank you so much for submitting your testimony. We were able to I was able to go through it quite. Is there any other discussion? All right. No discussion? I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 656, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 656.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 656.
Senator Gordley moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 656, and that is actually taking the word refer and substituting that with consult. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 656 as amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 656 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I understand the significance of the issue and the significance of the disease. But so far in the testimony, I still am not aware of what problem this bill solves. I do think there is a difference between protocol and scope of practice, and this is putting very specific protocol and statutes in an evolving science-based treatment modality. And, you know, I have total faith in my optometrist, and total faith that if I needed a referral, I would get the referral. And I just don't think this is really solving a problem, and I think this is not something we should be doing.
Is there any other further discussion? And I'm glad that people talked about Senate Bill 717, which is going to hopefully provide a very efficient, streamlined way of dealing with issues that come before the legislature like this. All right, with that, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter.
Aye.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Cruz.
No.
Senator Gordley.
Aye.
Chairman Anderson.
Aye. Motion passed, and Senator Carter will carry the bill. That'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 646, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 723 because we have a 10-year-old out there who needs to speak. All right. Shannon.
Senate Bill 723 creates an interim legislative committee to develop, with the assistance of advisory committee, a plan for coordination of services and creation of integrated funding of services to children with severe emotional or mental disorders. Sunsets on the date of convening of next biennial legislative session, declares emergency, and takes effect upon passage.
And colleagues, my intent is to want to move this to Ways and Means if that is the decision that the committee wants to has. Before I call the first statement, I want to make sure, clarify, since there is an amount designated, do we need to have a fiscal?
Yeah.
There's a designated amount of $5.5
million. But I think it's a choice, Madam Chair, if you want to hear the bill and get...
And refer it?
Yeah, but then to refer it, because it does have a fiscal.
It does,
yeah.
You don't need a fiscal. I mean, this is here, so it gets referred and it gets dealt with.
Right,
yeah. Okay.
We don't need that.
All right.
I don't know at this point.
Exactly.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
As the sponsor of the bill, if I could just make an
yes,
opening statement
do.
From here, very briefly... I'd like to defer to those who have come to testify in support of Senate Bill 23. And again, as you're pointing out, there is a Dash 1 amendment that would call for a $5.5 million appropriation for the purpose of funding the ongoing development and services of the Children's System Change Initiative to ensure that each child who needs services receives the level of care and wraparound services determined appropriate by a reliable diagnostic instrument. And with that said, I look forward to hearing the testimony of those who've come to support Senate Bill 723.
And we will be addressing the Dash 1 amendments. It's basically what we call a gut and stuff, but so it does replace the bill. With that, is it Zach? Zach Anderson, that's a good last name. Will you come forward, please, so that, because I know you have to leave. And his mom, who is from Polk County.
Good
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Akin Clem. I'm 11 years old. I live in West Salem. I'm going to talk about treatment today. When I was 7, I went to treatment. I had 18 different placements till last April. Last weekend, we celebrated my year anniversary of being home. I like being home a lot better because my family cares about me more than staff does. Almost. Also, there's no level system. Level systems don't work for me. What's been good about being home is making friends, playing sports, games, and doing other stuff with other people. Well, what's been hard about being home is having to go to daycare and when I'm older than all the other kids. I wish that there was activities where my mom doesn't have to watch me. I wish I wasn't afraid of going back to treatment or juvie. I think I might have to go back because I've been acting out lately. I'm afraid if I hit or hurt someone real bad, I might have to leave home.
Thank you so much, Zach.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Zach. We want to make sure that we pass a bill that's going to look at your needs and make life good for you as well as your family. So thank you very much for testifying. Mom, you didn't put your name, so we'll call you Mom.
I'm just Chairman Monis Anderson and Committee. Just thank you very much for coming.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Chris Anderson from West Salem and Zach's mom. And I just wanted to thank you for letting us be here and moving things ahead so we can get out for Zach's needs. And again, just in support of Senate Bill 723, wraparound services work. The help we've gotten with through the Children's Systems Change Initiative has been part of what has, I think, made this transition successful for Zach this time, and he has been home a year. And right now, he's no longer getting them because I now have health insurance. And I think the idea of the pooled funding and pulling resources from the different systems that we're involved with, we have child welfare, juvenile justice, and education involved in our family. And by pulling resources and helping create stronger and more community-based options, I think we wouldn't be as worried as we are right now how much longer he's going to be able to be at home and be safe. And if you have any questions for either of us, please.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Byrd.
I don't have a question, but I do have an assignment for Zach. When you get home, pull out your dictionary and look up the word courageous. Courageous. It takes a lot of courage to come forward in a setting like this and talk to adults in the way that you have this morning, with a lot of thought and a lot of courage. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to call Terrence Killian and Chris Kavink. Am I even close? And Gina Nickel. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Terrence Killian. I'm a program supervisor with Trillium Family Services, Perry Center for Children in Portland. I've worked with Trillium for about 8 years, beginning as a line staff in the residential program at Waverly Children's Home, and earning my master's in social work degree and returning as a program supervisor. For the past several years, I've been in management-type positions in the same programs, responsible in part for recruitment, training, and retention of direct care staff. Each year, a bright new crop of young men and women join the ranks of child care workers at our mental health facilities. They're sweet, caring, creative, idealistic, and fresh out of college. Their desire is to make a difference, to be a positive influence in the lives of children, many of whom have experienced appalling negative influences for most of their lives. They find they've gotten more than they've bargained for. in working with our children, these young men and women, sometimes for the first times in their life, are confronted with children's serious mental illness, violence, self-harm, and daily heart-wrenching situations that have sent us all home in tears at one point or another. In fact, I consider it a major success if a new staff goes their entire first week making it to the car before they start to cry. They don't all make it. The rates of burnout and turnover in these positions are incredibly high, in the range of 70% for turnover. Increasingly, we miss out on young men and women who could make a difference in the lives of our children because we are only able to offer pay at 30% below the market for this type of work. Our new staff leave college, come work for us, and oftentimes are faced with the starting realization that they'll need to choose between eating or paying student loans. Our bright and eager young staff see their college peers, who chose marketing or engineering as their fields of study, in vastly better paying jobs, buying new cars and homes, having no trouble paying bills. Once these staff are hooked into the work, they are constantly assailed by the internal conflict of working a job they absolutely wholeheartedly know must be done, and being unable to afford to live on what they're making at that job. As staff settle in, we start to notice their sick calls increase. The combined stress of paying bills and working an almost impossible job has taken a serious toll on their minds and bodies, and they become ineffective. Some staff have to take second jobs, waiting tables, or other more lucrative positions in order to support what we refer to as their social work habit. The best of our staff are able to manage the stress. But of course, as the best of our staff, they are the future master's and doctorate students. Within a year or so of coming to us, they start to make plans for their future. If they choose to continue to work full-time, their wages will not be sufficient to pay for school, and so they have to take on even more student loans and increase their debt and stress further. I'd like to share a relevant story I heard yesterday. Last week, we hired a new direct care worker who is a Canadian citizen. He came to us on a work visa, and since he was on a work visa, when he crossed the border, he had to inform the Homeland Security of his salary that he was expecting to make with us. They didn't believe him. They nearly kept him out of the country. They told him, you can't live on that in America. And they told him no American with a college degree would work for that little. In the end, the officers decided that this was the answer. Since they believed no American would work for that pay rate, we must have to pull people from other countries. And they allowed him to enter the states, thus putting Oregon's mental health care workers in essentially the same category as migrant farm workers. On the last page of my written testimony, I provided a few quotes directly from my staff to illustrate exactly how their poor income affects their everyday lives. I urge you to read them and hear what they have to say. It would be impossible to pay the staff who do this work the amount of money they truly deserve. They are heroes who have made personal and financial sacrifices that few people can truly understand. They must be given an increase to their pay to slightly ease the stress and burden they bear for the children of Oregon. The people of this state know this work is necessary and care for the children we work with. But rarely is the reality of the lives of those charged with the care of mentally ill children considered. It is the responsibility of the people of this state to give as much support to those working with these children as they do to the children themselves.
Thank you. And this is an issue we hear each session. We're very much aware of the problem, and hopefully with this bill, when we send it to Ways and Means, we might see some change.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Senator Mona Sanderson, other committee members. My name is Chris Krenk, K-R-E-N-K. And I am the president and CEO of Albertina Kerr Centers. Which
I thought the R was a V, so
I know. Well, I've been called worse. As I said, with Albertina Kerr Center has been there about 17 years, and really relate to the previous testimony and the time I've spent directing an organization that cares for children. We're celebrating our 100th anniversary this year as an organization, and so we're pretty adaptable and been around a long time, but times have been tough. It seems throughout the many years that we've been in business, we've adapted our services to problems that were present in 1907 and still are present today: child abuse, poverty, mental health challenges, developmental disabilities, and so forth. And we're very proud of past outcomes. One of the things I want to talk about today is my concern about our ability to continue to produce those outcomes under current financial challenges. I've included with my testimony some outcomes from our organization, but they're really representative of many other organizations, good organizations that are providing services to children in the state. The crisis we've got is really driven by the fact that providers have received no cost of living increases. Actually, it goes back even further. I was consulting with our mental health, one of the people who works with the mental health division. Rates for many of the programs were set in the 90s and really have not been adjusted since that time. And there have been very little cost of living increases over the last three biennia. And so we find ourselves with similar conditions to Trillium Family Services, where staff are turning over at 60-80%, which is double what they used to be. And these are people who are caring for some of our most disturbed children in the state. We're really hopeful that adoption of Senate Bill 723, as amended, would allow providers to continue to recruit qualified employees and retain those that are currently serving our children and families well. Dollars for this bill would specifically, hopefully, be targeted at employee retention, improved training and orientation programs, resulting in better continuity of care, and to retain our ability to get excellent treatment outcomes for our children. I really appreciate your time and interest. That really concludes my remarks. So I'm hoping that in addition to this bill extending services to more children, it also will improve the capacity, our existing capacity as well.
Thank you. And I'm not going to ask Bob Nickel to testify, but if you have written testimony, you can submit that because we're going to go into work session.
You hear from his wife, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
You're so terrible.
Madam Chair, committee members, and Senator Cruz. We'll talk later.
Yes, we will.
I'm the executive director, Gina Nickel. Dr. Gina Nickel. Thank you. Of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And we are in support of Senate Bill 723 with the -1 amendments. We have made tremendous strides in developing the Children's System Change Initiative. Tremendous strides. We are seeing more kids with better levels of care. And I'm told by managers, providers, and consumers themselves that we are on the right track with the changes that we've made to the children's system. Here's the problem, though. We are on a glide path that is unsustainable because we didn't allocate any resources last session to developing the infrastructure and to paying our therapists and our people what they're worth. And so we've asked private providers and our mental health organizations to upfront the money for development, and they've done that. So what we know is that they can't continue this any longer. I'm here, and I don't want to sound like an alarmist. I'm just telling you what is fact. We know what works. Let's fund it. We cannot see our children's mental health system decline when we've figured out what works. I ask you to pass Senate Bill 723 with the -1 amendments to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Mr. Nickel, do you have anything to add? Just one point, and then we'll move on.
I will gladly give up my chair.
I never let you forget that.
No.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Nickel. Not Dr. Bob Nickel, Mr. Bob Nickel, but thank you anyway, Senator Carter. And I'm the Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, responsible for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. I haven't actually had a chance to look in detail at the -1 amendments. My testimony was geared to the bill prior to the amendment, so I think I'll withhold that for now. And the one thing that I did want to raise to the committee was the language that I did see just was kind of vague about the funding, the $5.5 million, which, by the way, isn't in the governor's recommended budget, so probably technically I have to. That said, the language just refers to $5.5 million going to the provider. And I think the intent, and I just want to raise this so that it's part of the discussion, is that the funding would go to the direct service providers and toward their retention. And I'm not sure if that came through clearly enough in the fairly brief language, so I wanted to raise that as just a piece that you might want to
in the dash ones on page 2, line 2, to establish a mechanism to ensure that funds go directly to providers of mental health services to children and families in order to close the workforce compensation gap. So we
hopefully that will do it.
Okay, questions? All right, with that, thank you very much, panel, and I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 723, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 723.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 723.
Senator Gordley moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 723. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 723 as amended to full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 723 as amended to full Ways and Means. Did you say with a due pass?
With a due pass.
With a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 723 and I'd open a public hearing on Senate Bill 881. Shannon.
So Senate Bill 881 requires the Department of Human Services and local mental health authorities to work together to create local and regional plans for expanding community-based mental health services. It requires the department to report to Legislative Assembly.
Okay, Gina Nickel, Angela Kimball, and Jane Ellen Lydance, if you'd come and please make your comments very brief because we're very aware of this issue and we are planning to move it with the dash one amendments.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Nickel. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I could say good bill, do pass. I'm going to speak just for about 30 seconds here. I did not pass out the full community services report because I've passed that out before, but I want you to take a look at page 34. Of the community services work. Do you have that in front of you?
Yes.
I brought extra copies. I'll go get them.
I left mine is in my room.
Madam Chair, if I could have Angela speak next and while I get the copies.
Okay. If you give it to us early, evidently it didn't get into our...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball. I'm with NAMI National. I'm here as a family member of a child with mental health disorders. The other night I was in Portland, and like many of the hundreds who signed up and weren't able to testify, I just wanted to echo some comments that I didn't have the chance to make because I was there in my hometown. And I wanted to say to one of the co-chairs, who's my representative, Representative Nolan, that even though she lives very close to me, she lives on the other side of the hill. I live on the dark side of the Southwest Hills. And I mean that not just literally, but figuratively. Because while other people's children go to school and graduate and think about a life of hope and achievement, my child and the children of many, many families throughout the hills around our entire state suffer and do not graduate from high school. There are so many children in my very neighborhood who've been kicked out of school, who've ended up homeless, who don't graduate. My son was lucky. He graduated. But again, from a place where he had been sent away from his home school. For our children, for children with serious mental illness, life ends up often being a journey that involves child welfare, where 80% of children have serious mental health needs, ends up in juvenile justice systems, where in Oregon Youth Authority, close to 60% of youth have a mental health disorder. Our children end up homeless. They end up not graduating. but he can be different. In Washington County, there's a wonderful children's program, and I've heard from a family that got intensive wraparound services, and their life is completely different as a result of intensive community services. Their young child had been in the hospital numerous times, was about to be removed from their home, and today, this child, this family, is supported and well. But as our children age, and as they grow into adulthood, that journey into adulthood is often dark. And it often involves homelessness, incarceration, institutionalization. When the Oregonian ran its articles on the deplorable state of our state hospitals and the abandonment of cremains, that touched the hearts of so many families in our state, so many people who stay at home and don't mention that the pain they live with every single day. And I want to thank this committee and this legislature right now for taking the steps you have to restore remains to families who are concerned about their loved ones and to build new state hospital facilities. Your efforts to correct the shame of our past have been significant, and we appreciate that. And today, with these two bills, 881 and 723, you have the opportunity to address the living shame, the shame of the terrible conditions in which our members live with today. Last night in Corvallis, some of you may have heard from a young, or maybe not so young, but a woman who talked about her journey of recovery and the incredible joy she has now after having received intensive community services that have allowed her to live with hope rather than hundreds of hospitalizations. Today, we're here to ask you to bring that hope of recovery and that light of a brighter future to all Oregonians. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Gina Nickel, Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We originally crafted this bill as a placeholder. Senator Mona Sanderson and I were in a community services work group committee, and we saw the need for a placeholder bill. In March, then, the full report was issued. And if you remember, the State Hospital Master Plan Phase 2 says that the state hospital will not work unless you fund the front load of the system. So we did the work. You have the report in front of you. What I did was I copied page 34 for you so you can see the work that is done to estimate the costs on the front load system. We would ask that you pass 881 with the dash one amendments out to Ways and Means. We put the full price tag in there because you asked us to do the work. We did it. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
Chairwoman Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Whiteance, and I work with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm here representing the Oregon Community Mental Health Coalition. This coalition is a grassroots effort to really pull together all of the providers, all of the community advocates, and everyone who cares about mental health in our state to work together to come before you to ask for your help. My testimony talks about a reporter who called me and asked me what the community mental health system is doing in Oregon, and I said it's in free fall without a parachute and without a safety net. We have for decades turned our back on Oregon's community mental health system. We as a state have not made the investments we need to support the providers, to support our individuals with mental illness, and we are seeing the impact in our criminal justice system. Senate Bill 881 gets us going on that path of correcting that neglect, and we need your help. We urge you to vote pass out Senate Bill 881-1 amendments to Ways and Means today, please. Thank you.
Questions? Bob Nickel and Tim Malone. We get Tim to come. We didn't get you on that first bill. Sorry about that.
Good
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Bob Nickel, VHS, Assistant Director in charge of Addictions and Mental Health Division. I'm here to testify strongly in favor of the unamended Senate Bill 881. Once the funds get put in there, since they're quite in excess of what the governor's recommended budget is, I have to be in opposition to the amended bill. However, the concept of the bill is right on. The price tag, I just want to give a quick word of explanation. We developed that report based on what we heard from people, a broad group of people, including a couple of legislators, for which we are very grateful they were in attendance and involved. We didn't just dream up the number. We actually looked at the epidemiological data. We subtracted the people who already served, and then we attached model budgets to the types of services. So that's how we got to the numbers on page 34 that were passed out by Dr. Nickel. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I do want to testify that the concept of the bill is exactly on the right track, and that ultimately we do have to come to terms with front-loading the service system, and we have to figure out what's a realistic number to get started on this biennium.
Thank you.
Chairwoman Morris Anderson, committee. My name is Tim Malone. I'm a geral psychiatric specialist at Deschutes County Mental Health and former member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I can't say that I support or don't support the bill, obviously, but just by way of education, being in the county mental health system for 15 years, now I can tell you that it's in serious, dire straits. There has been an overall decline in services over the years relative to population growth. Working in the geriatric mental health field, it's almost non-existent in this state at this point, and hopefully this bill will address that. At this moment, it does not have language specific to senior mental health. I would very much appreciate some consideration in the final passage of this bill that it include very directly senior services because of the long and terrible history of county mental health systems very consciously and consistently choosing not to address senior mental health because of its complexity and its cost and the fact that there's no longer almost no practitioners in this state. Just to add something to a previous person, I changed professions midlife and became a civil servant, and only last year did my pay as a supervisor become dollar for dollar equal to my blue collar pay in 1986 when I changed professions. The mental health field is grossly underpaid. I've had an open position now for 6 months for a licensed clinical social worker, unfilled, because I simply cannot pay them to come and live in Bend. That's an emerging problem statewide. It's, of course, big time with a lot of professions in Bend. But just by comparison, in Southern California, there are thousands right now of unfilled mental health and social work positions because they can't pay them enough to live in that their communities. And that's occurring certainly in Central Oregon and in Portland as well. And so I hope this bill, too, will help to address that.
Thank you
very much.
Questions?
Madam Chair? Sure.
Yes.
Just a comment, given the witness last statement. On the page 34 that Dr. Nickel referenced, I would draw our attention to the note at the bottom of that page, which says that these funds, and that's the $100 million plus, will only provide outpatient services to 50% of the unmet need by 2015. These funding projections were reduced due to concern that the behavioral workforce would not be sufficient to deliver the services at the fully funded level. And the funds needed to fully meet all case management needs are in parentheses. Again, putting the emphasis on the lack of a workforce to meet the needs that we are describing and defining, and that's part of the free fall and lack of a safety net parachute comment that we heard earlier from Jane Ellen Wydance. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. And, okay, with that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 881 and open a work session on Senate Bill 881. And, colleagues, I am very much in support of the Dash 1 amendments. I know it's not in the governor's budget, but if we don't start making a statement now regarding the needs that our mental health system has, it's at least we're saying a statement. We're providing a statement, two ways and means. And I know that there are deficiencies in the budget. So that's, I just wanted to bring that to everyone's attention.
And I'm glad that you did, Madam Chair. Before I make the motion, just to extend your statements, if I may, this also points up the need for additional revenue into our system. In the Oregon Constitution, Chapter 9, chapter on finance, Sections 2 and 6, say in essence that when there are insufficient funds to operate government services, the legislature shall levy a tax. That's what it says in the Constitution. We all swore to uphold the Constitution. We rarely have a conversation in this building about that part of the Constitution. Of course, we do focus on the constitutional mandate that says we will balance the budget. Of course, we're going to do that. But we cannot any longer escape the fact that the revenue stream that we currently depend on, a revenue stream and system that was created in the 20th century, to meet 20th century needs, does not work. And it will not work to meet 21st century needs, like the needs that are before us in this this bill, the previous bill, bills in human services, bills in education, bills in public safety. So, you know, it's April. We're still here. There's an opportunity for leadership as we know it, and I'm speaking of all leadership, all 90 of us, but also those who hold key leadership roles, to look at where we are in Oregon. We're at a crossroads, and there is an opportunity. We have an opportunity that can be seized to talk about revenue reform. That must happen. And I am going to continue to use my voice for as long as I have breath and the and remain a part of this legislative assembly. I'm in my last term by choice. I'm going to continue to use my voice to raise the issue about the need for revenue reform. What we're doing to our state through the lack of investment in mental health services for the most vulnerable, what we're allowing to happen, the disinvestment in higher education, and on and on and on and on, is just unconscionable. We've got to call a halt to this, and the measure before us just points up once again that this is all happening on our watch. If we don't make the change happen, it isn't going to happen. But I believe that it can, that it must. And, Madam Chair, I'm just seizing the moment to express what's on my heart and mind, because I believe that we can do better. We must do better. We must do better. Thank you.
Thank you. Further comments? All right. Did I get out of public hearing? Then we're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 881.
Senator Gorley moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 881. Discussion? Opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 881 as amended to, is this going to Ways and Means? To Ways and Means with a do pass recommendation.
That's $105 million.
dollar.
Yeah, but it needs to go.
Yeah, so we need to make that motion.
She did. Yeah. Senator Gordley moved Senate Bill 881 as amended to full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. All right. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 881, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 154, and I am going to only have testimony on the amendments. Not on why we need this or that. I just want the amendments to be described. And so with that, I think we will invite Bob Nickel up, Sybil Shepherd. I don't see her. There she is. Okay. And I would like to put on notice Legislative Council. I think it's Chuck Taylor that worked with me. I hope that was right, because we may have some questions regarding that issue. Because we've already had public testimony on the bill, and we know there has to be something that has to happen. And so that's why I want to focus it just on the amendments. So with that, let us have Bob Nickel start with the -3 amendments and tell us what that does for us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bob Nickel, Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services, Addictions and Mental Health Division. The -3 amendment, as I understand it, would be less preferable to us. It would allow, it would be a second choice as far as we're concerned. I would like to encourage the committee to consider and adopt the -1 amendment. This really gives us what we have been advocating for, a two-year period of time where the division would quickly work with a bona fide group of stakeholders, as is our practice and is required, to develop administrative rules that would then go into effect for the two-year period and allow us to work through the issues of evictions in a systematic, careful way that both balances the rights of individuals as well as protects the effects of a very strong program, Oxford houses or recovery houses. I know that we're all trying to digest the 3 and possibly 4 amendments. I've seen -4 and -5 amendments, and I would go on record as opposing the -4 and -5 amendments because they don't allow for the kind of operations that would continue the effectiveness of Oxford houses. The -1 amendments have been supported by the Oxford House people. They've indicated willingness to go forward with a registration and probably a license process that would allow us to regulate those parts of the Oxford houses that have been controversial and would allow for exemption for them for the two-year period under the Oregon Landlord-Tenant Act.
Okay, so in layman's terms, the -1 takes Oxford House completely out of the landlord-tenant law, and therefore, if and the -3 take Oxford House completely out of the landlord-tenant law, correct?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding. Okay. And if there are more technical questions, I have asked Vicki Scria from my office,
okay,
who's been absorbed in this, and she can answer any technical questions that I can't.
So what I would like, you can come forward. What I want to know is if someone is discriminated against, if they are evicted and it truly was not for drug and alcohol reasons, which Oxford House has a clean policy. What is the recourse if they do not are evicted based on discrimination, whether that's race or religion? Thank you.
Personality conflicts.
My name is Vicki Scria, and I'm the manager for Housing and Homeless Services for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, if somebody is evicted for discriminatory reasons, it's my understanding that they could file a complaint to HUD, the state, if this new law passes for the state. And if we adopted administrative rules, all of our rules prohibit discrimination. As a state agency, we can't allow that. We would have requirements in there that would be prohibited, and people would have the opportunity to submit a complaint in a grievance process and do that. I actually just recently contacted people at HUD to clarify this in terms of that process, because it's our understanding in consultation with our assistant attorney general that people retain their civil rights in these homes. It's just living in this home does not deprive you of your civil rights. It deprives you, if you're not under landlord-tenant law, you can't use that process, but you can use other processes.
So I just clarify this. So if they, if the complaint, if the person who's evicted then wanted to appeal this, they would then go to BOLI and file a civil rights complaint, and then they would actually be, and if the process proved that they were in the right, they could claim compensatory damages as well as punitive damages, is my understanding. Under landlord-tenant law, that just would be compensatory damages for being evicted for false reasons. I need to know the difference.
Some of this would determine on how we wrote the administrative rules and what we put into them, what kind of civil penalties could apply. So since we would be in that process, that would have to be, you know, determined by nature of what got adopted in the rules.
All right.
Madam Chair, if I could just add, that is part and parcel of the administrative rule process, to look at all of these considerations and to provide those kinds of protections to people if we're going to be exempt from the Landlord-Tenant Act. I mean, that's the whole bargain, if you will, here, is that we set up a reasonable process that protects people's rights.
Thank you. Okay, Senator Gordley.
Oh, thank you very much. And again, would you repeat your name, please?
My name is Vicki Scria, with the Addictions and Mental Health Division.
Scria?
Scria.
Scria.
I'm sorry, it's S-K-R-Y-H-A.
Okay.
Just like it sounds.
Thank you. I would like to have in writing the understanding that you just expressed. What you're presenting verbally is one thing, but you've obviously been in consultation with a number of other people, including, I believe you said, the Attorney General or DOJ, Department of...
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the Assistant Attorney General assigned to our office.
Mm-hmm. Given the significance of the issue that we're trying to work through, you know, I want to be able to reference opinions that are from the experts and that are in writing, as opposed to passing on pieces of information. That doesn't work for me. So that's my request on this particular issue.
And could you do that then for the committee?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, Senator Courtney.
Well, it appears that you're going to do it by administrative rule, which is now being done by landlord-tenant law. Mm-hmm. Well, then why? You see where I'm going? But I don't know what you should have had in the AG in front of me. There, or that's the, I don't get it. I mean, why even have a bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, the idea behind developing administrative rules is they would be different from the provisions of the Oregon Landlord-Tenant Act. The idea, though, would be to tailor them to a type of program for which there really isn't a category under any current statutes, and that we feel doesn't really fit very well in some places under the Oregon Landlord-Tenant Act. So the idea behind the rules is not to duplicate the Oregon Landlord-Tenant Act, but you're right, that would be unnecessary. It would be to make what we would believe to be appropriate modifications in that process that would still allow recovery homes to provide alcohol and drug-free environments.
And the way I understand it is that
when someone starts abusing in this house, we need to get them out immediately. And that's why they have to, my understanding, why we have to sort of revise the landlord-tenant law. Because in the landlord-tenant law, if someone is abusing, we need to get them out because they lie, they steal, not all of them, but it's a very negative impact on the other families, fragile families, that are in recovery and in the transition home. So in the regular landlord-tenant law, if a person really cannot really be removed within 24 hours, I don't know all the specifics, and we may have you address that. But it can be up to 30 days through the appeal process to get them out of the house. And so that's why we have this bill before us, because we have to have a situation when someone is abusing to get them out immediately. And so that's what the dash ones and the dash threes would try to solve.
Madam Chair, I would say I would agree with you. I think the term, though, using needs to be broadened to include the concept of relapse, and that's part of what we need to look at here. It's not just when someone starts using, but there are, for many people, very clear signs that they are going to be doing that very soon, and that's part of what we need to work through in a reasonable way in an administrative rule process.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, just to make sure I'm clear on this, because I fully support this. We're exempting these facilities from landlord-tenants so you can write the appropriate rules to allow, and so this will be totally in the rule process, so they can be allowed to evict for specific causes. Using relapse behavior, that sort of thing. But at the same time, you're going to write in the rule protections to make sure that they aren't evicted just because. And from my perspective, Madam Chair, that's important because part of the process in Recovery House is learning how to deal with personalities and things like that. And so we don't want to set up such an insular environment that people could be evicted just because. So landlord-tenant does not allow for this sort of specificity, and so the dash one will allow you to create the rules to safeguard basically both sides in this situation, correct?
I'm sure Senator Cruz, that is very correct.
Thank you.
Now describe, before we move on, the difference between the dash ones and the dash threes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, dash one exempts DHS licensed homes from the rules. It's silent on the exemption of recovery homes. The dash three amendment specifically exempts the recovery homes for a 2-year period of time and references the federal statute that defines those homes.
And Oxford House is considered a recovery home?
Yes.
And so the dash three would narrow it to just
for with a 2-year sunset, but dash one would have, we believe, the impact of exempting them.
Awesome. Okay, thank you. All right. Yes, Senator Courtney.
Do you mean to say this kind of facility is exempted from the land use, the whole thing?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, that was the original intent of the bill, to do a blanket exemption. I think we're very comfortable working with the Dash 3 amendment because it doesn't give a permanent exemption here. It requires us to work together over the next 2 years.
But it totally exempts it for the next 2 years. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, it exempts them, but on the condition that we develop rules to regulate this process.
Chair, I don't know if you're trying to move this today.
I do not plan to move it today because we just got the amendments, but I want the amendments to be described to you. So if we can go with the dash twos
from Ed Johnson from the Oregon Law Center and the Dash Fours in 6 minutes because we have to be on the floor of the Senate. And then we will continue this discussion next meeting, so we will carry it over. And I would like to thank everyone for coming that's here, but we truly need to, we know what the problem is. We truly just need to work out these amendment pieces and have a good understanding with the committee. So that's why we didn't ask for public testimony. And I know Ann Uhler is ready to testify too, but we're going to ask for these statements next Monday. We'll carry it over. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. First, let me say, from our perspective, the Dash 3 amendments and the Dash 1 amendments, or what I should say is the Dash 3 amendments and the original Senate Bill 154 are essentially identical. While there is a sunset provision in the Dash 3 amendments, it would allow from beginning of next year, Oxford House's to lock people out with 15 minutes verbal notice upon a majority vote for any reason. That's the way that Oxford House operates. That is in their manual, and that is why we've been fighting about this for so long. And so from our perspective, the promise of future rulemaking simply is not satisfactory. If rules are developed, that would be the time to come back and talk about what they look like and what sort of protections they provide. We have provided two different amendments that we believe attempt to strike the balance between protecting the fundamental right of 1,200 Oregonians living in these 150 houses to have their day in court before they lose their homes, to have an opportunity to tell their side of the story before they are kicked out of their home. The Dash 2 amendment, from our perspective, is the safest route because it gives everyone an opportunity to have their day in court. Now, the problem that you raised is the other side of the balance, which is Oxford House needs to quickly get rid of people who are using in their houses. And the Dash 2 amendments may not be quick enough for them in certain circumstances, although by their own admission, 99% of the people, when accused of relapse, move. What we have suggested in Dash 2 is that instead of having Oxford House covered generally by the Landlord-Tenant Act, they be specifically placed within the existing drug and alcohol-free provisions of the Act itself. So they can give a 48-hour notice demanding that the person either leave, and it sounds like 99 times out of 100 the person will, or demanding that person remedy their behavior, presumably by going into inpatient treatment. If they don't do that, and the person stays and fights, perhaps because they contest the allegations, then it does take time. It takes, depending on the county, 8 to 14 days to get to court. Although in my experience, attorneys like myself can go to ex parte. If there's an emergency, if there's a safety issue, they can go to ex parte and they can get a faster court appearance. We believe that Dash 2 protects everyone, and it can be monitored in the next 2 years to see how it affects Oxford House. I believe that Oxford House will continue to thrive. However, if the committee believes that they need a faster way to get people out in relapse, we have provided Dash 4 as another way to strike this balance. Dash 4 leaves Oxford House under the Landlord-Tenant Act, but gives them the extraordinary remedy of removing tenants who have used or have refused to take a drug test without going to court. So those people will not have an opportunity to talk to a neutral fact finder. They will not get their day in court, and they will be removed. But they'll be removed with 24-hour notice, which in our experience is a lot better than 15 minutes when you're gathering your stuff, your kids' stuff, and trying. I mean, 24 hours is not so good when you're trying to find a new place to live, but it's better than 15 minutes. And so it does provide meaningful protections, but it gives Oxford House the extraordinary remedy, and I believe it would be the first time that Oregon would have ever sanctioned landlords to lock out tenants without going to court. I would note one other thing, and that is that in addition to our usual allies on this issue, the disability rights community, the fair housing rights community, the tenant rights community, the poverty law community, there's a letter in the record before you from the Oregon Rental Housing Association, an organization of 4,500 landlords that have stepped up and have opposed Oxford House's and DHS's position on this bill.
it's amazing to me that they would take the initiative. I mean, these are not our natural allies on these issues. They would take the time and the initiative to oppose it. Why would they do that? Because mainstream responsible housing providers know that the Landlord-Tenant Act works, and they understand the risks and the dangers of taking the law into your own hands. Majority vote, self-help eviction, removing people without due process of law, it's just not the way that we take away people's homes in this country. We strongly oppose Dash 1 and Dash 3. It's been very frustrating to spend the time going through this work group. Not that I don't love coming down to Salem, and not that I haven't enjoyed meeting with Vicki and Bob, but to go through all that meeting after meeting and essentially be in a position where DHS and Oxford House have not budged from their original position because they believe that they're right. But nonetheless, it's been frustrating to go through that process. We strongly oppose Dash 1 and Dash 3. Dash 2, we believe, is the safest option. If the committee wants to give Oxford House this extraordinary remedy, Dash 4 is another viable option to strike this balance.
Okay. Committee, I think another thing that we need to have in front of us is the eviction process that Oxford House uses. And I have, and I don't know if you have, the membership contract. And that basically is their eviction process. So if you do not have it, I want to make sure that you get that. Because what the committee has to do is look at these amendments, understand what the eviction process is, which is membership contract, and I'll get make sure that. And then I think we have to go to the floor right now, and then we will come back and finish this discussion on Monday morning.
Madam Chair,
yes,
yeah, there's
Senator
another
Gordon.
Piece of information I would like,
yes.
As I weigh the Dash 2s and Dash 4s. Thank you for the testimony. The history of evictions from Oxford House, if we could get some information that would give us a history over a span of time, 5 years or less, that gives us the reasons for eviction, so we know what we're talking about here. Okay. Thank you.
And I'm so sorry that I have to cut everything short. I do want the public to know that we will just be discussing the amendments. We truly don't need any public testimony because you were so good in conveying, Oxford House people were so good in conveying their needs before. So the few people that can address those amendments that we were discussing, I thought we were only going to do three and four, but it looks like we've got one, two, three, four. Okay. Yeah, we're going to carry Senate Bill 1. Yes, go ahead.
Madam Chair, if I could just point out that written testimony we submitted did go into some detail describing at least our perspective on the Dash 1, 2, and 3 amendments.
So yes, you did.
That. And if you would like, we can provide you with a copy of what we're calling preliminary draft rules so that you can get a glimpse into how we think this would
very
play
helpful.
Out with the proviso that this, you know, we still have to go through the process, but it just gives you a glimpse into the thinking about how we would approach this.
And I only plan to take a half hour max on this on Monday. I'm still not sure we'll be able to pass it, but I want the committee to be thoroughly feel very comfortable. Every member, I want to feel very comfortable with that, whatever decision we're going to make. And that might be a no vote or it might be a yes vote. Okay. All right. Thank you. We are also, so I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 154, and we are carrying over Senate Bill 847 for Monday, too. With that, I'll close the, we'll adjourn. I guess that's what I'll do.